Chapter 8. The Charismatic Leader.
The Osama bin Laden I Know. Disc 10.
The attack on the USS Cole confirmed bin Laden's position at the helm of the global Islamist jihad. Bin Laden's reputation was an important factor in drawing aspiring jihadists to Afghanistan, many of them from Western countries who had heard about the Saudi militant through radical preachers, websites, or simply on television. Indeed, something of a bin Laden cult was taking shape in the period between the U.S. cruise missile strikes in Afghanistan in the summer of 1998 and the 9/11 attacks. That cult helped fuel an unprecedented volume of recruits to al-Qaeda's camps. It also attracted various militant Islamist groups into affiliate relationships with al-Qaeda. Though bin Laden was careful to take security precautions that limited his accessibility, many aspiring jihadis heard him come to speak in al-Qaeda's camps. This made a personal audience with al-Qaeda's leader that much more sought after. And for those who sought to undertake a mission on behalf of al-Qaeda, some form of meeting with and final approval of planned ventures by bin Laden was de rigueur. Bin Laden's modus operandi, though, was to leave much of the operational planning to trusted lieutenants, such as Abu Hafs and Saif al-Adl. He was a figure that, for the most part, stood above the fray, interceding only occasionally in the everyday running of al-Qaeda. Abdessattar Dahman, a Tunisian who had settled in Belgium, assassinated the Northern Alliance leader Ahmed Shah Massoud on the 9th of September 2001 after being personally recruited to do so by bin Laden. Dahman traveled to Afghanistan in 2000 after being inspired by seeing bin Laden appear on a television news item in Belgium. His wife, Malika Malik, remembered the moment vividly as she explained in a self-published book she wrote in French about her husband's experiences in Afghanistan, entitled Soldiers of Light. One day, Osama bin Laden appeared on the news. "Look at that face. Don't you think that it is beautiful?" he said to me. "You are very handsome, too," I told my husband. "I love him," said Abdessattar. "Me, too. I love him," I replied. When Abdessattar was speaking of the beauty of Osama bin Laden, he was alluding to the light of faith illuminating his face. At that moment, but only that moment, I confused Osama and my husband in my head. Because the love I feel for my husband is one of a loving wife, but that of Osama as a great brother in Islam. I don't believe for a minute that he ordered the 9/11 attacks. What serenity I saw in both their expressions! I turned my eyes to the face of my husband and towards that of the Islamic leader, whose expression was fixing on the camera to call out for combat against the aggressors of the poor and the unarmed, the Muslim community. And a frisson went through me, and I felt a presentiment that God only knows. Something had just put a shadow over the happiness of Abdessattar. He was scared of dying without having made the supreme effort on the path of God, jihad. And he had the impression that it was to himself in particular that Osama was delivering a message. In a series of interviews in Yemen with Khalid al-Hamadi, a correspondent of Al-Quds al-Arabi newspaper, Abu Jandal provides an insider's account of al-Qaeda. Those interviews appeared in the Al-Quds newspaper in August 2004. Abu Jandal described his first meeting when he was personally recruited by bin Laden in 1997 as beautiful. In this extract, he describes how he was chosen to be bin Laden's chief bodyguard in 1998, and how he then acted as a troubleshooter for bin Laden, insulating his leader from internal disputes in al-Qaeda. "I was chosen to be bin Laden's personal bodyguard after I completed all my training courses. There was a specific incident after which I was chosen. We were sitting in a gathering in Kandahar, and a man arrived belonging to the Takfiri stream, the ultra-hardline Islamist group that had earlier tried to assassinate bin Laden in Sudan. He was called Abu al-Shata, the Sudanese. Right there in the gathering, he began to speak offensively and rudely to Sheikh Osama. Because I moved around the city a lot, I recognized the man as a member of the Takfiri group. When Abu al-Shata then drew close to Sheikh Osama, I spoke out, 'Sheikh Abu Abdallah, bin Laden, allow me to sit next to you.' He replied, 'No, there is no need.'
I repeated my request and insisted on it because I was afraid for his safety and feared that the man might do him harm. I loved Sheikh Osama deeply, and indeed, after a while, I stopped calling him Sheikh and started calling him Uncle. Finally, after a lot of entreaties on my part, bin Laden said, "Come and sit behind this door that is next to me." I went behind the door and kept looking out for any sudden movement from that Sudanese, fearing that he might assault him or even try to assassinate him. Sheikh Osama, meanwhile, kept his hand on his pistol while talking with the man. Finally, the Sudanese man did something strange and stretched out his hand towards Sheikh Osama. Without thinking, I threw myself on the man and sat on top of him until he could no longer move. He screamed for help and said, "I did not do anything." I told him to keep quiet or I would remove his head from his body. Sheikh Osama laughed and said, "Abu Jandal, let the man be." Afterward, he told me to take the man out of the house and lead him away. After that day, Sheikh Osama gave me a pistol and made me his personal bodyguard. The pistol had only two bullets for me to kill Sheikh Osama with in case we were surrounded or he was about to fall into the enemy's hands so that he would not be caught alive. I was the only member of his bodyguard who was given this authority to kill Osama, and I was to use this pistol. I took care to keep the two bullets in good condition and cleaned them every night while telling myself, "These are Sheikh Osama's bullets. I pray to God not to let me use them." According to our security arrangements, if enemy forces surrounded Sheikh Osama and there was no possibility that he would escape, I was to kill him before they could catch him alive. For 6 months, the period during which I was personal bodyguard, I constantly stood behind his back and accompanied him round the clock. He refused to be captured alive. He would become a martyr, not a captive. And his blood would become a beacon that arouses the zeal and determination of his followers. I remember that he used to say, "Martyrdom rather than captivity." This was his frank view. My basic duty was to defend Sheikh Osama. Sometimes, however, he sent me as his representative to some Al-Qaeda outposts and camps. I was regarded as his representative during debates. He sometimes instructed me to visit some military outposts to talk to people about certain issues that troubled them. I sometimes examined those issues and their causes and presented my view to Sheikh Osama to make a decision. Actually, there were rivalries among Al-Qaeda members depending on their countries of origin. The Egyptians used to boast about being Egyptian. The Saudis, Yemenis, Sudanese, and Arab Maghreb citizens used to do the same thing sometimes. This troubled Sheikh Osama, and he used to send me to them to help eliminate these regional rivalries because the enemies of God, those who have sickness in their hearts and informants, would exploit these ignorant attitudes and try to sow divisions and disagreements among Al-Qaeda members. I regarded myself as someone properly educated by Sheikh Osama. I regarded him as a father. I believed that if we wished to confront our strong enemy, or confront the broad front that the United States wielded against us, we needed to unite among ourselves and eliminate regional rivalries. The Sheikh himself did not personally intervene in these issues, and I frequently intervened to solve these problems in my own way, even without telling the Sheikh, because I used to regard myself as being one with Osama bin Laden, one with the Al-Qaeda organization, and one with the Islamic Nation. Would-be Al-Qaeda recruits often had to go through vetting procedures before they gained prized access to bin Laden. Shadi Abdallah, a Jordanian of Palestinian descent, briefly became bin Laden's bodyguard in Afghanistan in 2000. The following are summaries and direct quotations from Shadi Abdallah's interrogation by German police after his arrest in 2002. His interrogation provides an illuminating account of how he reached bin Laden's inner circle, his experience of Al-Qaeda's training camps, and a first-hand glimpse of bin Laden's strong appeal to Al-Qaeda recruits as he bragged about major planned attacks against the United States. Shadi Abdallah moved to Krefeld, Germany in July 1999. On December 14, 1999, Abdallah traveled in a group of five persons from the Krefeld Mosque from Germany to Saudi Arabia and later to Pakistan and Afghanistan. In Mecca, he met a man by the name of Abdallah al-Maki, alias Abdallah al-Halabi, who recommended that he go to Afghanistan where the true Islam was taught. al-Maki, who Abdullah later discovered is a son-in-law of Osama bin Laden, gave Abdullah the telephone number of a contact in Karachi, Pakistan. This contact guided Shadi Abdullah to a Taliban center in Quetta and arranged for him to be smuggled across the border of Afghanistan into Kandahar. In Kandahar, Shadi Abdullah stayed in an al-Qaeda guest house, the so-called Arabic House, for about 1 week. That is where he met Mohammed Atef, alias Abu Hafs, Osama bin Laden's deputy, as well as Saif al-Adl Makawi, alias Saif al-Adl, Abu Hafs' deputy. Both interviewed him regarding his abilities and about his political and religious attitude. Abu Hafs suggested Abdullah learn fighting before deepening his knowledge of the religion. In early 2000, Shadi Abdullah began military basic training at Camp Al-Farouk near the airport in the city of Kandahar, known as Airport Camp. While in the training camp, he was sworn into participating in the jihad. He was taught the basic ideological extremist attitude of Al-Qaeda. Shadi Abdullah ended his training prematurely after approximately 20 days due to a head injury he suffered while at the camp. He was admitted to a hospital and treated for this head injury, and upon release returned to the Arabic House. During his subsequent two-week stay at Osama bin Laden's headquarters at the airport in Kandahar, he met Ramzi bin Asheba, the 9/11 planner. Abdullah enjoyed a special position of trust within the leadership circle of the camp because bin Asheba had recommended him and Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, al-Maki, had sent him there. Bin Laden's daughter married him when she was 15. Al-Maki acts as bin Laden's bodyguard, and secondly, it is his job to win people for bin Laden's cause. This he does very skillfully by at first putting the question of jihad into the background, but later on making an open appeal. He is, in addition, a well-versed martial artist. For example, he boxes well and knows how to use knives. Also, he is a good shot. All of bin Laden's guards are skilled in weapons. Shadi Abdullah's direct remarks to German interrogators follow. I had gotten from bin Laden's son-in-law a phone number which I was supposed to call in Pakistan. I reached a person named Hamza. I stayed with him about 48 hours, and he then took me to Quetta. That is a city in the region bordering on Afghanistan. I entered a large house there, a Taliban center. The actual purpose of this house is to receive injured Taliban fighters, but it also has three rooms which are intended as guest rooms for Arabs. In the first few days, I was questioned a lot by Ramzi bin Asheba. A special status within al-Qaeda was documented by the fact that he wore a head covering that was reserved in Afghanistan for secret leadership-level persons. When I met him for the first time in Afghanistan, there were very few persons in the guest house in Kandahar, Afghanistan. At that time, bin Asheba wore no veil. Later in 2000, when many new recruits came to Kandahar, he usually wore this veil because he could not rule out the fact that there could perhaps be spies and traitors among them. When I was asked if I wanted to become a bodyguard for bin Laden, it was because of a shortage of personnel. After all, other young men asked to do this job. I was watched over and checked over in my activities. I was allowed into bin Laden's vicinity when he was on the move. Then I always had to walk behind him. We had one task and one task only, to protect bin Laden. Those bodyguards who had been on the job for some time were also entrusted with other tasks. From all this, it was obvious that we were not trusted 100%. There are two ways of becoming a member of al-Qaeda. One can take a so-called little oath or a big oath. The first one is taken in the presence of Osama bin Laden. In essence, one promises him to keep the secrets and to obey him. One simultaneously shakes hands with him. The other possibility, that is, the big oath, contains the same promise, but in the presence of Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader. The training camp had the shape of a big oval. The buildings were made from light construction material. Only the kitchen and the officers' building were from stone. The mosque consisted of straw. The sanitary facilities were made from tin. The Afghans put up the buildings for money. We also bought daily necessities like food from them. Russian arms, rifles, as well as small firearms, were also bought from the Afghans. The training sites for each of the training components for example, house-to-house warfare, lay around the camp. There was also a part that was separated from the camp. It was for bin Laden's stays. Al-Qaeda financed everything. Newcomers to the training camps were lodged in special guest houses. They had to hand in all their belongings, bank cards, passports, etc. In conversations, the instructors tried to find out if the newcomers are sincere. There was much fear of spies. After the basic training, it was possible to receive special training in an area of special talent and/or interest. The final decision rested with Abu Hafs, bin Laden's deputy. Possible areas included tactical training in mountain, urban, or desert warfare, anti-aircraft combat on rocket grenade launchers, fighting against armored targets, that is, tanks, terrorist attacks, and assassinations. Special training for poisons was offered at Camp Abu Khabab. All special trainings took place in separate camps to which only persons enrolled in the training had entrance. The training units usually consisted of 6 to 10 people at most. Each unit had a name. The trainees slept in tents of 6 to 10 people. There were also a few cases where only 2 people were in a tent. Each tent had a supervisor who was responsible. This person had to inform the others when an instructor was coming. He had to report, for example, when someone was sick. He was responsible for discipline in the tent. The first subject in which we were trained was the use of firearms. The second subject included correct behavior in outside terrain, camouflage, forms of movement, deception. In the third subject, they taught us how to orient ourselves outside. The fourth and last subject was the use of explosives. The arms training lasted 3 weeks. All other subjects involved a week of training each. During my training, I did hear the instructor frequently talk about the U.S. as an occupying power in Saudi Arabia. This was meant to incite the trainees against the U.S. At the Kandahar airport, I saw a large map of the Arab world. It also showed the location of bases and ships of Western forces, for example, of the British, the French, and the Americans. This included the whole Gulf region, the Middle East, and Turkey. They also showed propaganda movies about Chechnya, Bosnia, Saudi Arabia, Palestine, Afghanistan, Indonesia, and Somalia. One time they showed a movie about the USS Cole. After the training sessions, we had meetings at night with the instructors in which we talked about mistakes and misbehavior of the trainees. Punishment was marshaled on the spot. It was a very frequent and popular punishment to let people climb the mountains in complete darkness. The punished had to give signs with a flashlight or shouts to show they had in fact complied with the punishment. In particularly severe cases, we had to fill big containers with water and carry it on our backs on the way up. The containers were very heavy. A relatively frequent punishment was they would order you to take off your shoes. You then had to walk in the hot sand at noontime. Many young men broke off from the training or would have liked to. This was generally not a problem if someone important had sent them. It was different with those who had come by themselves or did not belong to any faction. These people would even be tortured. This happened also during the training period. Popular torture methods were beating with cables, strangulation until almost death, tearing out of fingernails, and food and sleep denial. I can remember someone who died while I was there because he had been strangled for too long. In Kandahar, there were 2 cells which had ropes hanging from the ceiling. People would be tied to these ropes by their arms. In addition, there was a tiny cell without windows that was always dark. Many people were put in there so that they wouldn't have any space and no air to breathe. They would go literally crazy. Bin Laden met high-ranking foreign guests in some sort of guest house that was outside the area he used as private living quarters. Whenever bin Laden drove anywhere, which didn't happen often, he used a black pickup truck. He was very secretive about his trips. He'd just show up surprisingly. Bodyguards would clear the route before bin Laden would pass through it. Bin Laden was generally not greeted with much fanfare, since his trips were secret. Only when a propaganda film or something similar was being produced did the organization fire rockets, etc., to impress the press. While on tour with bin Laden, I noted several disagreements between the boss and his men, for example, over potential targets in the U.S. I also witnessed the detention of several people as spies. Those were usually critics of bin Laden. I want to say that bin Laden is a very charismatic person who could persuade people simply by his way of talking. One could say that he seduced many young men. In our conversations, he asked me if I was ready for the jihad. He said that our common path must be the sacrifice for Islam. This was the right path. I responded that I wasn't ready for that yet. I would have to deepen my religion first. Bin Laden constantly talked about attacks against the U.S. I know that from others. However, he didn't name specific targets as far as I know. It was said that he wanted to break the back of the United States. I don't know what exactly he meant by that. Abu Jandal describes living with bin Laden. He explains that the simple manner in which bin Laden lived was inspirational to his followers. My wife used to live with me in a special compound for the families of the Mujahideen at Kandahar Airport in southern Afghanistan. As for the families of the Mujahideen who lived in Kabul, they used to rent small houses, just like other Afghans. Indeed, the Arab Mujahideen in Kandahar and Kabul used to share with the Afghans their numerous occasions, their weddings and their sad occasions. We lived a normal social life, but in a society that was alien to us in language, environment, and way of life. Bin Laden used to go to the wilderness outside Kandahar with all his wives and little children. He would ride with us in his private car, and his family would ride in a bus. His grown sons would follow us on horseback, although the distance was about 1 hour by car. He would then sit with his wives, and we used to take the car far from that place so that he would not see us and we would not see him. We would communicate by radio. In that place, he would teach his wives how to use firearms. They would play together and do some simple physical exercises. He used to lead a normal family life. He was a fine horseman who loved horses. He did not ride daily, however, but he had a lot of experience with horses. He knew about pedigree and could tell a horse's likely lineage by simply looking at it. Perhaps his early wealthy life and his contacts with the Saudi ruling family taught him that, because the ruling family members loved horses and racing. Other members of the bin Laden family also loved horses. Sheikh Osama, moreover, loved horses from a purely religious perspective because the Prophet, may God's prayers and peace be with him, used to say, "There is goodness in horses until the day of judgment." Bin Laden sometimes arranged horse races among the organization's members. Once he came and asked me, "Can you ride a horse, Abu Jandal?" I said, "I can drive anything, but I cannot ride a horse." He said, "What a shame," and instructed me to take lessons. But I evaded the training and did not finish the course. So we never really felt afraid as long as we were with that man. We ate with him, walked with him. Our love for Sheikh Osama springs from the fact that we went hungry together and were filled together. We wept and rejoiced with him. We were joined by a common destiny. We lived a full life with him. The man was very simple in all his dealings and in everything in his life. He was consistently very generous with others. No one ever came to ask for financial assistance and was rebuffed. An Arab brother who wished to travel abroad came and explained his difficult circumstances to him. Sheikh Osama went into the house, came out with whatever money his family had, which was around $100, and gave it to the man. I was aware of the Sheikh's financial situation and said, "Abu Abdallah, why did you not leave a part of that money for us? Those who are staying here are more deserving than those who are leaving." He replied, "Our situation is not hard. God will send us money." For 5 days after this incident, we had nothing to eat except pomegranates that grew around his house, although they were not yet ripe. We ate raw pomegranates with bread 3 times a day. I believe that God raised Osama bin Laden to a high status because despite his great wealth, he was very modest and attached only to what rewards God would give him. He treated his family and children in the same way. He brought his children up in a simple way of life to teach them self-reliance in everything. I remember that when we were staying at the Kandahar airport post, his son Saad came and said, "Father, I wish to get married." Osama said, This does not concern me. Rely on yourself. The son said, What should I do? Sheikh Osama replied, Take this plot of land and this budget. Till the land, and from the revenue that you get, save money and get married. And the son tilled the land and raised crops. His father merely gave him advice on how to do it. Thus, he relied on himself and got enough money to get married. Sheikh Osama used to give to each of his sons a plot of agricultural land and a budget to cultivate it. Bin Laden accustomed his sons to shoulder responsibility and rely on themselves, not on their father's millions. I used to hear him telling his sons, Sons, your father's millions about which you hear are not for your father to use. This money is for the Muslims, and I hold it as a trust for the cause of God. Not one rial of it, the equivalent of 30 cents, is for you. Each of you is a man. Let him rely on himself. I spent most of my time with him because I was his personal bodyguard. When his family moved with him from one place to another, when he visited Kabul, for example, the group of bodyguards, which consisted of 14 to 16 men, traveled with him. His family, which consisted of his wives and children, used to ride in a bus accompanied by a vehicle full of guards. His three wives lived in one house that had only one floor. They lived in perfect harmony. Sheikh Osama was firm in managing his household's affairs, just as he was firm in handling matters outside his home. We never heard about any conflict among the wives. One comes from a Syrian family, like his mother. Two are Saudis. His last wife, whom he married after divorcing Ali, the mother of Ali, is a Yemeni. His first wife, Abdallah, the mother of Abdallah, is a Syrian. The other wives he married after he embarked on a life of jihad. I know that his wife, Khalid, the mother of Khalid, is of the al-Sharif family and was the sister of one of his jihadist comrades. I left Afghanistan for the final time shortly after his Yemeni wife arrived. I heard later that she had given birth to a daughter. After my final departure from Afghanistan, which occurred 2 months prior to the bombing of the U.S. destroyer Cole in Aden in October 2000, I heard that all his wives stayed with him in Afghanistan except for his first wife, Abdallah, who left before the incidents. I remember that his male children who were with him in Kandahar up to the time I left the country were 9. If we add Abdallah and Ali, the number of his male children would rise to 11 from all his wives except the last one, the Yemeni wife. As to daughters, there is no possibility of knowing the number. Those volunteering for al-Qaeda missions often sought out contact with bin Laden. The following interrogations of al-Qaeda operatives reveal that what they remember most is time spent with their leader rather than detailed discussions of their planned attacks. This planning tended to be managed by bin Laden's top aides. Nizar Trabelsi is a Tunisian who became a professional soccer player in Germany. In his late 20s, he drifted into drug addiction and then turned to Islam, subsequently traveling to Afghanistan in 2000, where he became an ardent bin Laden disciple. Trabelsi was arrested in Brussels on September 13, 2001, and was interrogated by Belgian police officers. He told them that al-Qaeda had tasked him with the bombing of a NATO base in Belgium. Nizar Trabelsi. This meeting with Osama bin Laden dates back more or less to some weeks after the attack against the USS Cole on October 12, 2000. At night, this person, Abu Zubaydah, an al-Qaeda recruiter, came to me and he took me to a villa in the Jalalabad vicinity in eastern Afghanistan. I arrived in a room where many people were gathered. I shook the hand of the many people who were present and I sat down. Right then I realized that Osama bin Laden was attending. After eating, Abu Zubaydah took me to Osama bin Laden. It seemed he had already gotten news about me. Abu Zubaydah explained to Osama bin Laden that I was a soccer player and I had recently converted to Islam. He also said that I came to Afghanistan to stay here with my wife and help the local people. Osama bin Laden told me that if I needed something, I could ask him. After 2 or 3 weeks, I again tried to contact Osama bin Laden through the man who looked after his villa. I addressed this man, and the following day I had an answer. I could get to Kabul on Saturday to take the plane leaving at 8:45 bound for Kandahar. When I reached Kandahar, someone was waiting for me at the airport. He attended my first meeting with Osama bin Laden. That man took me to a house called Dar es Salaam, where only people invited by Osama bin Laden are allowed to enter. This villa was an hour and a half from the airport. I had a shower and I ate something. The person who picked me up told me that Osama bin Laden was not there, but he could probably arrive during the night. During the night, the man who waited for me at the airport and picked me up took me to another villa where I met with bin Laden. He was happy to see me. I was so impressed when I saw him that I didn't dare to speak to him. He asked me questions about my family, and realizing that I felt uneasy, he tried to cheer me up. I stayed there 3 days, and I was always with Osama bin Laden. I was his guest. During this time, we chatted about many aspects of life. During my stay, I met with Abu Hafs, the Egyptian, and with Dr. Ayman Zawahiri. During my first stay in Kandahar, I didn't dare to explain bin Laden the problems I dealt with, being so deeply impressed by this figure. This was the reason why I stayed there only 3 days. My second stay lasted 9 days. I took the plane on Saturday, and I came back on the Sunday of the following week. I told him all the troubles I suffered during my life. I spoke of my father and mother. In the end, Osama bin Laden told me that I could consider him as my father. This is the reason why I'm very fond of him. He told me that I could stay with him and that he could help me.